Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Hoping to have you a good lunch. Give him a warm welcome, Jim Wang.
Great, thanks guys. Hope everyone had a good lunch, as mentioned. I'm Jim Wang. I work on the ASP.NET and Visual Studio team. And today I'm here to talk to you about ASP.NET Web API and SignalR. Actually, it's not a lot of slides. What we're actually going to do is go and build a web application from File New Project and really see how you can light up the different technologies that we produce. So we're going to be using ASP.NET Web API. This is the latest changes that we've shipped in the February release that you can get through the web platform installer right now. I'll include links to that and also provide some highlights of what we shipped. SignalR, which is our framework for producing real-time web applications. It makes it really easy for you to enable, I guess, protocol negotiation. So what that means is, let's say I have a WebSocket server and I want to do a real-time push. Well, what happens if my client doesn't support WebSockets? Well, now I've got to think about HTTP streaming, long polling. How do I support those older clients? SignalR takes all of that away from you because we handle it. You focus on building your app and your logic, and we'll see how easy that is to light up in a real-world application shortly. We'll also be using Knockout. So for those of you who haven't seen Knockout.js before, it's a client-side MVVM framework. Helps you to write cleaner JavaScript code that interacts with your views. And it's a lot better than having it just set either in the same script file or without using a model. And so I'll provide we'll go from Hello World to more advanced Knockout very quickly as we build the application. And so please feel free to interrupt me at any time. Obviously, we're going to be coding this up from basically File New Project, so there are going to be mistakes, and so you will be able to see what the debugging experience is like as well. So feel free to interrupt me anytime, and I'll be happy to answer questions. So first, we've got some slides to get through. So we'll start with ASP.NET Web API. The background for Web API is we thought about this problem of, say you're creating an application. Well, how do you reach the different clients that are out there, from browsers to mobile devices and tablets? And once you've done that, how do you actually make that service scale without having to do a lot of configuration or deal with SOAP? So the answer, predictably, is ASP.NET Web API, where we provide a really simple framework for you to create HTTP services that can reach a broad range of clients, including browsers and mobile clients. And the reason that it allows you to do that is it provides the negotiation for the content type. So if you request JSON, it gives you back JSON. If you request XML, it gives you back XML. And that's kind of the cornerstone of Web API. So modern programming model, easily map your resources to URIs. Anyone? And so if you're thinking of, let's say, an employee, we're doing routing based off of the HTTP verb that you're providing. So instead of having routes that do RPC type of calls, you're actually working with entities, which is a lot cleaner and maintainable. We provide content negotiation, as I mentioned. So you want JSON, we'll give you JSON. You want XML, we'll give you XML. Really allows you to broaden your reach across the various client devices. We provide request validation. That comes basically for free with a lot of the work that we've shipped with data annotations and models. Flexible hosting. Most people host Web API on ASP.NET, but we do have a self-host option, so it's also lightweight. Currently, it's available as NuGet packages, fully open source. We've shipped some additional features in the February release that just came out, like help pages, which I'll be showing in the demos later on. So as we think about the biggest thing that we shipped in February, it's actually OData support. And so if you guys came to the talk yesterday, you'll remember I mentioned that there are two ways to use this. The first is to just add a queryable attribute to your existing Web API controller, and that will allow you to make OData-like queries against that API endpoint. However, we also shipped the ability for you to go and create an entire fully-fledged OData service that is standards compliant, supports those common patterns using that protocol that enable real scenarios like paging and metadata. So what we're going to do is take a look at OData. First three steps to configure your model. We need an entity data model so we can provide that paging support and other great things. You've got to configure OData routing, so you're actually going to go off a different route than the base Web API route. And then you're going to implement an OData controller. So in this case, you're going to inherit from the entity set controller, which provides a lot of great wrappers for common functionality that you're going to need when going against your entities. The example that we'll be showing today is patch support, so HTTP patch. Say you only want to change a specific field on an entity, it doesn't make sense to do a put because you're going to have to supply the existing values. And so this is something that we've shipped with OData. It's on the backlog for ASP.NET vanilla web API, but it's a great feature that you can take advantage of today, and we'll show some of that. This is some background on why you need a data model, because we need it to provide great functionality like paging. We can do more work for you if you give us a data model. Key point here is that you don't necessarily need to be using Entity Framework. This can be any data source that you'd like for those lines of code. You're going to have to change the sample code a little bit, but obviously you're free to choose your data source. This is the query support that I talked about. So the queryable action filter enables this. You can do this on both vanilla web APIs and a fully-fledged OData web service. We also support query validation. This is actually something that's really important that often gets glossed over. And this is the ability to restrict the query options that somebody is applying to your OData service. So when you light up OData query support, you're actually allowing all the various different queries. And some of those things may be undesirable. Like if someone is going to write a denial of service attack against you and just keep on calling any, which goes and enumerates everything, that's probably going to be an issue. And so we've shipped some great extendable support for you to be able to restrict what queries you actually allow in your web API. And this is something that we strongly recommend you do if you control both the server and the client. Or even in the case where you're building an open web API for the public, there are some things that you would never need them to do for your particular scenario. And paging is also easy. It's just part of the queryable attribute. What are we thinking about next for ASP.NET web API? We're thinking about security with OAuth and JWT, which is the JSON web token. And so basically, that's going to provide additional easy authentication as we move web API to a more modern authentication model. We're also going to go and fill in some of the queries that we don't support right now in OData. So that's expand, select. We're going to have OData scaffolding our templates. Right now, when you go file a new project, we give you a vanilla API controller. We don't actually have an OData project type, so that's definitely something that's coming, which will make it a little easier to get started. We're going to do SignalR integration, potentially, and that's something that I'll actually show in my demo in my app, and also support for cores and JSONP as a first-class citizen. So these are things that we're thinking about implementing. We do love feedback, so feel free to come by after the presentation or just ask questions, and we can talk about some of this. Great. So that's Web API. How about SignalR? So SignalR is basically designed to make it incredibly easy for you to interact with real-time WebSockets or long polling or HTTP streaming connections, and it provides that automatic protocol negotiation that is really so valuable. Pillars we thought about were simplicity, reach, and obviously really high performance because you're dealing with so many concurrent connections. Right now, it's up on GitHub. It's open source, so a lot of the discussions in terms of where we're going next are happening there. 1.ORTW is available with the tooling. I'll show some of the tooling and item templates that we shipped as part of that release in the demo. Currently, we support the following clients. So jQuery, the ones you would expect, .NET, Silverlight, Windows Phone, Windows RT. Some of the things we're thinking about for the future include pure JavaScript. So right now, we have a jQuery dependency in our JavaScript client, but it's not something that's as difficult to remove. So that's something that, based on community feedback, and actually, to be honest, since it's on GitHub pull requests, we're looking into. C++, Monotouch, Objective-C, Java, let your imagination run wild. It's really based off of what the community wants to use, what you guys feel like is going to be valuable, and what we can ship in the time frame. And the time frame is actually every month. So we're trying to ship really quickly, try to be agile and get improvements out to you guys as quickly as we can. We're obviously trying to improve documentation and samples. It's been a whirlwind year for SignalR, so there's a lot of focus on that that we're going to go back and revisit. And also more templates and scaffolding, and some of which we'll kind of show today. And the most important thing is last, but it's scale out. And so if you think about having basically a whole bunch of clients connected to a single server, what happens when you need to add another server into that farm? How do you manage those connections? Well, it turns out you need an authoritative backplane to be able to say, okay, this client was connected here, but then they connected here, so still push the message out to them, and being able to manage that. And so we provide three first-class citizens for that backplane, so Service Bus, SQL Server, and Redis, which is an open-source project. All right, Knockout.js. So Mockout.js is our client-side MVVM framework. It's open source. It's actually built by a gentleman in our team, Steve Sanderson. And what it really provides is, I figured I would just copy the website. No need to rephrase it. It provides declarative bindings. So that allows you to bind your UI to your view model. And what that means is when you update those objects in the view model, because they're bound, you get automatic UI updates. And so you're not having to wire anything up, because Knockout is doing that for you under the covers. We'll take a look at a Hello World example that'll clarify this as well. You get dependency tracking, so you can have a dependent or computed observable. So let's say in the Hello World, you'll have first name and last name. Say you want to compute an entire name. So what happens is when someone changes the first name, the entire name changes because it's a dependency. So it provides a really nice way for you to set up those relationships in your object model. Finally, templating, which we'll be using today, is a great feature that allows you to use different templates depending on what state your application is in. So in our case, we're going to have like an edit mode, we're going to have a locked mode, and we're going to have a read-only mode. And so we're going to use templates to enable that behavior. Provides a really clean way for you to switch out views dynamically depending on where your application is. All right, enough talk. Let's code. We will start by going to Knockout and going over this quick Hello World example. Here you can see that when I modify this text box, the computed observable here updates. And the way that this works is Knockout has this data binding syntax that binds to these observable these properties. So you've got a first name, a last name, and then a computed observable, which is the full name. And the way you specify that is just KO for Knockout.computed. And you return the observables in line. And so really simple, really easy for you to get set up. If you think about how you might have implemented this before, the code will probably look a lot worse in terms of you having to hook up event handlers to figure out, OK, when do you update that actual the Hello Planet Earth portion of it based off of the previous two text boxes. So that's kind of a very simple Hello World case study of why you would want to use Knockout. Also, this is the link that I was talking about earlier that will be included in the slide deck in terms of OData security guidance. If you are planning to use OData in a production environment, that is something that I highly recommend you look at. It's kind of a rough boilerplate checklist of things that you want to look at in terms of restricting the different query operators, as we've discussed, allowing only certain order by properties, maximum node counts, the any and all functions. So really great resource for you just to, takes you 5 minutes to go through. And you can much better be able to control and understand what you're deploying to production. Great. So let's take a look at the application that we're going to be building today. So it's a very simple employee viewer. So what you can do is from one client, I can edit. You'll notice that immediately a message gets sent over to the other client that says, hey, this entity is locked for editing. Can do it from the other client. I've got two-way messaging that's going through SignalR hubs. And so you've got the automatic protocol negotiation and all that other good stuff lighting up. The actual editing of the entity, so if I make this change, also gets pushed out through Web API and through SignalR. And so you're able to take advantage of patch requests in this particular case, because you really only want to update that particular field and not the rest of the entity. And so we're going to be building this from file new project. And I've got a Git repository set up that has the different stages of the code in case anything goes seriously wrong. So basically, for those of you who aren't familiar with Git, what I've done is I've gone and switched back to the master branch, which has the Web API new project template. So I go ahead and reopen my site. And if I run it, you'll see that this is indeed the new Web API project template that you're going to get if you just go new MVC project Web API. And the reason the CSS is not actually displaying is because in the previous version of the site, I changed the site.css file. When you move it back, the browser still caches that file, so I had to do a forced refresh to get the original site.css to load. So this is what you would see if you went File New Project MVC and selected a Web API project. You notice the help pages support that we shipped provides some documentation for this default values controller that we provide. This is not necessarily extremely valuable in our particular scenario, so I'm going to go ahead and delete it. And I'm going to start from a model. So we're going to go out and build out our employee model. give this a few properties. ID, name, email, and then just to mix it up, a salary. Then we're going to go ahead and build our project, and we're going to do what many of you are most likely familiar with and scaffold out a new web API based off of this model. Call this the employees controller. Give it a model class of employee and create a new data context. And so this is going to light up entity framework so that we'll have a data context to go and talk to our database through. I click add, goes and scaffolds out the controller. And once this is finished and we build the project, the really nice thing here is the API documentation that we showed is going to be automatically updated. And so really great way to keep your API documentation in sync without you having to write any additional code. So here now we're looking at the API documentation for employees. It gives you an idea of what a typical response might look like. This might be a little small, so I'll zoom in. For the GET request, it shows you the different formats that we do provide as part of content negotiation. So that's both the JSON and the XML. We also have them for all the other verbs that are supported. Nice tips on where to define the parameter, in this case in the request body, and the formats that we support. So we also have a prototype feature where we have a built-in Web API test client that I talked a little bit about yesterday. So that's also something we're considering investing in. But since we're a little pressed for time here, we're going to just quickly move on. One of the other things that we're thinking about for the future is to redo our templating story. And one of the really popular frameworks right now is Bootstrap by Twitter. So for folks who haven't seen Twitter Bootstrap, it provides a lot of nice things. It's kind of like HTML boilerplate before it, except it provides a lot of base level components. And so when I'm building my application, I can focus on just building my business logic, building out the backend pieces that I'm going to need to support. And I don't need to worry about, oh gosh, how do I style a table again so it doesn't look horrible? How do I, you know, make a button out of a link? These sorts of like very boilerplate things, absolutely taken care of by Bootstrap. Great experience, something. They've got great documentation as well, which is really rare. So really easy to use. Recommend you guys check it out if you haven't. I use it actually in all of my demos and all my projects. And if you weren't on .NET, and so obviously this is just HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, the way you'd get it is by clicking this button. It downloads a zip file to your drive. You've got to unzip it, go and copy all the resources into your project. But fortunately, since we're using Visual Studio, there is a NuGet package that we can go and download. So I just go and search for Bootstrap. It is the first result. I install it into my site. And the nice thing about this package is it also follows the .NET conventions for where content should go. So you'll notice that all the CSS files end up under the content directory, and the scripts end up under the scripts directory for Bootstrap. Now, what I'm going to do at this point is just take one of their examples and copy the markup, and then just merge that into my layout page for the default template. So if I go into my layout page, views, shared layout, I'm just going to do a copy paste. The very bottom, they have references to JavaScript. So this is going to be for any Bootstrap components that require JavaScript, like the modal pop-up. We don't necessarily need them in this project, but for completion, we're going to go ahead and copy that script over. I also deleted some fav icon resources that we're not going to work with. So just for clarity, this top part is the original layout, and I'm just copy-pasting things down into the new one. So got a call to render body here that I'm going to put inside of the container, and then I'm going to copy this markout into index.cshtml shortly. You'll notice that I'm rendering a script section here at the bottom for performance reasons. I've also got a render of a bundle called jQuery, which is the jQuery library. For folks who haven't seen ASP.NET bundling, the configuration for these bundles actually lives under app start in this bundle config.cs file. Whoops. And you'll see here that we're just defining the jQuery bundle as being the latest version of jQuery that is in your scripts directory. If I go back, I'm going to also just drag and drop a reference to Bootstrap.js from the scripts folder. copy out this markup into index. So we'll go to index, remove all of this, and replace it with that. And the really nice thing here, too, is because we have action links in our page that actually are inside of an unordered list, our menu is just a straight copy-paste with no additional editing required for those LI elements. Format the document. Also make this link work to point to home. And then finally, I'm going to have to go and update these references to the CSS files. You'll notice that by default, Bootstrap's convention is actually under assets CSS. We know that ours are under content, so we're going to go ahead and update that as well. And then finally, we're going to add a link to our previous CSS file, which is in a bundle. We'll go and clear that up because we don't need actually any of the previous styles, and then we will change the title to pull from the view bag. So a lot of things, but relatively straightforward in terms of getting started and just copying over stuff from the template to make sure that you're getting the right markup for Bootstrap. I did forget to clear out my site.css, so this is going to look a little weird. But if I refresh, you'll see that I'm up and running with the Bootstrap template in pretty much less than 5 minutes. I'm ready to go and ready to use and leverage those components, which we're going to start doing pretty much almost immediately. So you remember that I went and created out an employee object, and I went and scaffolded out a web API controller for that. Now I want to go put some data in there. And so one of the a great way to do that is to use EF migrations. I don't actually know what happened here. Interesting. We'll just reload the Package Manager console. So if you go to Tools, Library Package Manager, and you click on Package Manager console, this is the NuGet Package Manager, which is also the way that you access Entity Framework migrations. And apparently, okay, nothing happened. I'm going to go ahead and enable migrations for my project. And then I'm going to add a migration for the initial create. And so EF CodeFirst migrations provide a great way for you to respond to updates in your database schema, sorry, in your model, and map those to your actual database. So say later on in this demo, I'm going to add a property to my model. I'm now able to programmatically go and update my database so I'm not losing any data, and I'm also making the migration in a way that I understand and that is safe. So add an additional migration. I'm going to call this initial create. Great, and so you'll see here it says, hey, go create out the employees table with all the different fields. Inside of configuration, which is this file that was created when I first did enable migrations, there's this seed method. I've got a snippet that has the content that I would like to seed. It's just some basic employee information. And then I can go and run update database to apply the changes and also run the seed method. And so that's going to get all the data into my database. So the next question is, okay, well, how do I know that actually worked? Well, we could go over here to Server Explorer and actually look at the database, but what I'm going to do instead is I'm just going to build out a live grid view of the data here, and then we'll be able to see that. So I'll get started by creating a view model in that case, because this is when we're going to start using Knockout. So I'll create a folder called app where I'm going to store my view model, which is going to be a JavaScript file. Employee view model. And a view model is nothing more than just a function. I'm also going to write some boilerplate code here to apply bindings to this view model. So for folks who aren't familiar with jQuery, this is the shortcut for waiting for the DOM ready event. And so after the DOM is ready, I'm going to go ahead and apply bindings and instantiate my employee view model. Great. So right now, the employee view model doesn't have anything in it. Well, I can go ahead and fix that. I'm going to create this variable self that will reference the this context. So this will be the root context for my view model. That's just good to keep track, because this is going to change depending on where you are in, let's say you're in a function callback. This actually is in the context of that callback and not in the context of the root view model. And accessing that context is something that you're going to do a lot. So the next thing I'm going to do is create this employees variable. And this is going to be an observable array, because I want to be notified when there are changes made to this array, so any additions or deletions. And then I'm going to do a call to getJSON. And what that's going to do is it's going to hit my API endpoint, API employees, come back with some data. And what I'm saying is when you get the data back from this API controller, go ahead and set employees to be the data. Then all that's left to do is to go and build out the view for this. And so right now I've got the view model that has all the data. Now I just need to figure out a way to display it, and I need to bind my front end to that. So I go back to index.html, CSHTML. Create a table, and I'm going to give it a class of table, which is how Bootstrap knows that it's a table, and it should go and style it. Add some headers. So we had name, email, salary. I'm going to create a tbody. And this is where things are going to get interesting. So for the tbody, I actually want to use Bootstrap. Sorry, I actually want to use Knockout and say, for each employee, I want you to render a row. And in that row, I want these table cells to be bound. Their inner HTML should be the various properties. And then I just got to define my script section and provide references to both Knockout and my view model. So if everything worked like I expected it to, if I refresh my page, now we're going to go off and hit the server, and nothing is going to come back, apparently. So what is wrong? It turns out we have a couple of errors. It says, hey, employees is not defined, and object has no method employees. Ah, right. So while I was typing this out, you'll see that I defined var employees, which is not the global context. What you actually need to do is self.employees so that you're actually pushing it into the correct context of that view model so that Knockout works correctly. And if I refresh now, you'll see that I actually do get the data back. And so, you know, definitely when you're doing client-side programming, there are going to be all sorts of errors that you're going to have to go look at. And the F12 tools, which basically work in any browser at this point, will provide you with access to JavaScript errors. Knockout actually does a fairly good job of interpreting and also showing you what's wrong and what you actually need to go and fix. So that was pretty nice, but I think one more thing I want to do here is just add a nice loading indicator that pops up when the server is actually doing work. Because right now, if this request takes a long time, you're not necessarily going to know that anything was going wrong. For example, when we first rendered this page, we weren't sure if the page wasn't working or if it was just taking a while. So I'm going to add that loading indicator. And actually, a really quick way to do this is on my view model, I can just create this observable called loading, set it to false when the view model is instantiated, and when everything comes back, set it to true because it is loading when you're instantiated. And then when you come back in the callback, we set it to false and everything is good to go. And so now all I've got to do is go back to my view and add some UI for this. Have a loading indicator, and I'm going to data bind it so that it's visible only when, I think I called it loading. Yep, only when loading is true. And then for the table, I'm going to do the same thing except the opposite. So don't display the table unless you're done loading. Obviously, this class means nothing right now, so I'm going to go map that. And I'll also go grab a loading icon off of my desktop that I can put into my project. Go back to my CSS file. Loading indicator. And right now I've got Web Essentials installed. How many folks have heard of Web Essentials? Okay, awesome. If you don't have Web Essentials installed, it's a great package put up by Mads. If you're ever doing CSS editing, it's pretty much a must-have. It's up there on the extensions gallery, so you should just be able to grab it from there. But one of the nice things that it does provide is if I do a URL and I say images, and I found my loading indicator, and I'm all good to go, if I mouse over here, it'll actually go and show the image and also show me how big the image is. So I don't have to go and hunt around my file tree for how big that is when I'm actually doing the CSS styling. Because by default, this div isn't going to have any width or height. So if everything worked correctly there, when I refresh this page, I'm going to get a nice loading indicator, and when everything has come back from the server, loading indicator goes away, and the page is displayed. And so you'll notice that a lot of the code we've written so far is actually pretty clean. I remember doing this back when I wasn't using MVVM, and just to get to this point was not as trivial. So just something good to keep in mind. Knockout.js does have a little bit of a learning curve, but it's a worthwhile investment. There's also other frameworks out there that people use, including Angular, Backbone. Organizing your client code, especially as complexity, there's a lot of complexity that's moving there, is something that's really important as a general pattern. Otherwise, you're going to end up with completely unmaintainable code. Cool. So next thing we're going to do that I don't really like about this site is that my salary is actually just displayed as a number. The other thing I don't like about this is I'm only getting paid $1, but that's a separate issue. What I'm going to do now is write my own custom binding, because Knockout doesn't actually handle displaying currencies. But what it does do is every single one of these values that you see is called a binding. And so in this case, I'm saying text, go set the inner HTML of this element to whatever the value I'm binding to is. There's also one for value, for input types, but there isn't necessarily one for currency. So I'm going to go ahead and add one. And that's another great thing about Knockout. It's really extendable. Create custom bindings. I'm just going to grab a snippet for, this is what you get when you go for help on how to write a custom binding on knockout.js.com. And you'll notice that basically there are two functions you need to write, init and update. So what happens when you first load the binding, and then what happens when the value that the binding is bound to changes. In our case, it's actually going to be the same thing. All I want is to append a dollar sign in front. So I'm going to grab the element. The only two that we actually need here are element and value accessor. And so what I'm going to do is say, when you're initialized, output the following. So just dollar sign plus value accessor. I'm also going to do a tofixed built-in JavaScript function just to format this so it actually looks like a dollar amount. Then I need to go into my view, add a reference to this custom binding so it actually shows up. I actually forgot to name my binding. Right now it's called your binding name, so I'm going to call this display money. And then if I go back into my view, and instead of doing text, I just say display money, and I refresh my page, I am now making $1 in actual currency. Yay. So a really great, really extensible way for you to change the way that you are displaying stuff on the front end, extensible. So check out custom bindings, really useful feature. Next feature we're going to use is templating. So you remember that, you know, in the finished demo app, we've got this concept of input text boxes. You can switch back and forth. As we're building it out right now, we're kind of going to want to be able to debug and edit the fields, because we want to be able to listen to each one of those property changes. So I'm just going to go ahead and lay a little bit of groundwork for templating right now, and I'm going to just permanently display the text box-based template. All right, I'm going to call this the read template. And the read template is going to be this, so the same thing that we had before. And then I'm going to create the edit template. And that is going to be different. That is going to be table cells with input elements. I'm going to make them all text. And in this case, we're going to use a different data binding of value, because we want to set value instead of inner HTML. And I'm just going to bind to the same properties. And it's probably going to be faster if I just copy-paste this line and call this email and salary. And in this case, I don't have to use the custom binding for display money, because I just want the value to display for editing purposes. And then I've got to go to my row and tell it to use the template. So go template. Give it a name. I'm going to set it permanently to the edit template. And for the data, I'm going to say, go take the data that is currently in the context of this for each iterator. So this is a special type that Knockout recognizes that just says, take data. And so as far as you're concerned, data is just the employee object that you're working on right now. And so what's going to happen is, as you iterate over the employee's observable array, you're going to hit this particular line. It's going to say, OK, I'm looking at one employee right now. I need to render this template. And in the context of this template, I'm just looking at the name property. So everything just passes through like you would expect. And if I run this site, you'll see that things have stopped working. OK, so what happened? Well, it turns out that there's a JavaScript error here. I don't know if you can read this. It says uncaught type error, object function has no method clean. And so I took one look at this and I'm like, okay, well, I copied the code off of the knockout samples. I'm pretty sure this isn't something that I've done wrong. So I wonder maybe if this is a bug in knockout. And so instead of going and checking to see if they fixed the bug, one quick thing I can do is just see if there are any package updates for knockout. Go to updates, you know, maybe Steve's fixed this bug already. You'll see that there is. Currently I'm running 2.2.0, which comes with the templates, and 2.2.1 has come out. So if I do update, this quickly updates my site. Just update my script reference here. I'll be using the new version of knockout, and hopefully Steve has fixed this bug, and he has. So just another great example of using NuGet to keep track of your dependencies if you run into issues that, I guess in this case, you're pretty sure were not your fault. So good to see that Steve has fixed the bug. And now we're going to go ahead and just show the fact that, hey, you know, you can edit the text boxes. What I really want to happen here now is when this text box changes, I need to be able to interpret that change and intercept it on the client side. Unfortunately, by default, the observable array object provided in knockout only listens for changes to the actual array. So what that means is if I add an item to the array, it knows about that. If I remove an item, it knows about that too. However, if I change a property of a complex object that is inside that array, it has no idea about that, right? Because all those are just static properties as far as the object is concerned. So what I actually need to do at this point is to go back to my employee view model and make sure that when the data comes back, I'm actually doing a mapping and making the properties on that object observable. So if you think about it, you've got an observable array, and inside that observable array, I want each of the entities to have properties that are observable as well, so that when they update, I'm able to get notifications on them. And so this is going to be critical when we think about our end-to-end scenario of interpreting those field edits. I need to know what ID the row is, I need to know which field changed, and I need to know the new value. And so those are three pieces of information that I'm going to try to get out of my front end. So if I use this great utility class, array map, to map the employee, and give it an ID. In the case of ID, I can just go ahead and set it straight up because I don't actually need ID to be observable. It's not going to change on the client. Name, however, is, so I'm going to make this an observable. And I'm going to do the same thing for email. And the same thing for salary. Missing a closing bracket here. Great. And then I can just return the observable employee. And so this will go and make everything observable. But wait, who gets the changes? Well, it turns out that because all I'm doing is data binding, I need to be able to, the UI is going to get the change, and it already kind of does. But I need to be able to interpret that in my actual view model so that I can push that change over the wire up to ASP.NET Web API. So it turns out that with Steve's help, I was able to write some of these model helpers, which I'm going to copy-paste in and talk through. So at a very high level, I'm going to call this function called watchModel, which is going to take a model and a callback. And what I'm going to do is enumerate all the keys in that model. And so in our case, you can think about me going through name, going through email and salary, making sure that property is actually observable. And if it is observable, what I want to do is listen to it. So I want to subscribe to changes on that property. And I've got another helper method that does that. This is a very simple helper method. It just wraps the fact that because I don't actually have control over the keys, I need to use this array indexing syntax to actually go and subscribe. Subscribing to observable objects is a really powerful scenario when you need to extend functionality of knockout. And obviously, given this is a common scenario, I'm sure Steve's looking at additional ways of making this easier. But as of today, we've got this helper function ready to go. And that means I can just go ahead and call self watch model. I want to watch observable employee for any sort of changes. And I will give my callback function the name of self.model changed. The signature here is model, key, and value. And we're going to go old school on this. I just want to see things pop up in the browser. So I'm going to alert all these properties. Refresh the page. And now you see when I make changes, it says, hey, okay, great, you changed the first row, which is, has an ID of 1, you changed name, and the new value of that property is Jim Wang with an AS at the end. So basically now we've got all the client-side wiring that we need to go and change our watch model function, or sorry, our model change callback, to actually go and do useful work. One last thing before we move on from this stage is that you'll notice that I've now made salary an observable instead of just a flat property like it was before, which means I need to update my custom binding to have this additional execution context that will actually get me the value, right? Because now it's an observable, and value accessor isn't going to do anything. It's just going to be, here's an observable object. You have to actually execute the observable object to get the value. Minor change, it doesn't actually affect us right now, if you remember, because we're not using that binding, but it's something that we will run into later on when we start implementing the switching back and forth. Great. So now we're at a point where we want to make a patch request up to Web API. As I mentioned before, vanilla Web API unfortunately doesn't have this support right now, so we're going to go and build up an OData controller. So if I go to this file, Web API config, under app start, that's where I'm going to write those lines of code that you guys saw in the slide deck earlier to set up my EDM model and routing. So very straightforward, there's a convention model builder. I say, here's my entity set, this is my EF type, and I want to create an entity set called employees, build up my model, and then I apply the model into the route so OData is actually aware of it. Next thing I'm going to do is jump into my controller and make sure I'm implementing an entity set controller. Employee int. And then I'm going to load up references to this. I'm also actually going to go clear out the existing contents here, except for the dispose. And now I'm going to start overriding methods. So great feature of Entity Set Controller is that a lot of things you need to implement are provided here as overrides. And so if I override get, you'll see that it's got a basic implementation. It's got a method signature set up for me already. In this case, I want to return db.employees. Done. I can go and override getEntity by key to get a specific employee. And that's going to be a little more complex. It'll still be one line. Obviously, in production code, you want to be using a repository pattern. For this demo, I'm going to be accessing the data context correctly because we might be here for a little while longer if we actually tried to build it out that way. And then I'm going to implement what I'm actually interested in, which is the patch entity. And that shows up right here. So this is where the code that I want to write becomes interesting. So I'm going to say, first of all, since you're giving me a key, I'm going to go pull out the entity from the database. So I already wrote a function for that. Great, give me the employee to patch. Next up, we've got this new function. We've got this new type called a delta. And what this is it keeps all the properties that have actually changed, and it allows me to apply that to an entity that I pass in. So in this case, since I already pulled the employee to patch out of my database, all I have to do is just say patch.patch. And that goes and looks at this object, figures out what properties have actually been updated, and applies them. So now the employee to patch object is completely hydrated with any new values that came over the wire. Then since this is entity framework, I've got to do a state change so that when I call save changes, the database knows that the entity's actually changed. I need to go and persist that to the database. And then so Visual Studio stops complaining, I'm going to return the employee to patch. And this is actually going to push it back over the wire as well. Great. So really quick way for me to set up patch requests and in a very friendly programming model. And I'm now able to go into my client-side code and push up a patch request to the server. I've got this as a snippet as well. Pretty straightforward. I define a payload object in JavaScript. Then I set the key to the value. So this is the key that is actually changed, and I'm setting it to the value. And then I stringify that payload because I'm actually making a JSON request through the dollar AJAX helper. And so it's really important to recognize that I'm setting my content type, my data type, and I'm actually running a JSON stringify. Because by default, if you run a patch request without these settings, jQuery actually defaults to a form patch. So it's going to form URL encode this. Or sorry, form encode it. And what's going to happen is OData is just not going to recognize it. One other thing I'm just going to have to change here, because I do have an OData controller, is this route here. And because we have metadata, the data is actually wrapped up in dot value, which we'll show over the wire when we run this site. So if I go build. Oh, looks like I still got some alerts from the previous time I was running. All right, things come back as I would expect. I can now make changes, and those changes are actually persisted up to the database. And so very easy. If you look at the request over the wire, it's going to be a simple patch request as promised. I'm doing an OData patch, and I'm sending just that property that's going up. So really great way for me to reduce my network traffic as opposed to a put request where I would have to provide all the properties and have to do some other logic. So really powerful, really great feature. There's one more thing I wanted to show. So if you go directly against the OData, by the way, this is case sensitive. If you go against this route for employees, you'll notice that the reason I had to do dot value is because now everything gets wrapped in a OData service service construct. And so this follows OData standards and also provides, like if I were to enable paging on this endpoint, I would have an odata.nextlink property that would come down that I could follow to go to the next page as well. So that's why I had to go and make that change. And so a really powerful feature that we provided. As you saw, it was really only three steps. I created an EDM model. I set up routing so that I went off of this OData route instead of the default API route. And then I went and inherited from Entity Set Controller. Cool. So now that, actually, I probably shouldn't have closed that, but now that we've got database changes going up over the wire, it's time to add SignalR, because otherwise, I'm not going to get these changes until I manually refresh on the other end. So to add SignalR, I'm going to add a hub. And to keep things organized, I'm going to create a new hubs directory. And then I'm going to right-click, add new item, and search for SignalR. And you'll see that there are two options provided to me. So the first option is a hub class. Hub is a higher level abstraction that allows you to deal with groups and also provides basically good properties for doing others as well. For example, I can say, hey, go send a message to everyone else who's not me, who's not the originator of the message. Whereas the persistent connection class is more of a lower level API that doesn't provide a lot of those benefits. If you're more interested in the protocol negotiation bits, then that's kind of the class you want to use. We imagine 95% of people are going to start with a hub, and so that's where we're going to go. I'm going to call this employee hub just to differentiate it from the employee class. But one thing I am going to have to do in that case is attribute it with hub name, so that I can also just still call it employee instead of employee hub when I write the client-side code later on. So let me just resolve that namespace. Great, we've got a SignalR hub, and we're ready to go. Well, actually, it turns out that's not true, because what I really want to happen in this case is when you make a request to this patch entity web API endpoint, I want to then go ahead and say, okay, everyone else who wasn't associated with this particular request, I want to send a message to you to say, I've gone and updated this property on this entity. Go update your view model. And basically, there's no way that my hub and my controller are actually interacting. Fortunately, and this is the support that we're thinking about fleshing out and obviously making a little more generic, I can create a new class that just extends the Entity Set Controller class and adds a hub property. So code for this is going to be up on GitHub, by the way. Sorry, I forgot to mention that at the beginning. In case this is breezing by, if you have questions at any time, please do stop me. I'm kind of heads down, so just yell at me or something. So cool. So Entity Set Controller with hub. And I have code for that as well. So that was easy to write. But you can see basically what it's doing is it is just initializing a hub and providing that as a protected property off of my actual web API. So now when I go back to the employees controller, I'm going to do entity set controller with hub and pass it an employee hub. And now that provides me with this nice property where I can say clients all. The reason I don't have access to others here is because of the way that the context is initialized. So when you're going directly against a hub, you have access to others. But because you're initializing in the context of a web API, we don't actually pass that information back and forth. However, in this case, it's not a big deal because when I do the patch, it's OK if I send out the message back to you because you're just going to go update your view model to what it was before. So there's not actually any sort of real impact for that particular scenario. But obviously something that we're also looking into improving. So this is the SignalR content syntax, which basically has a dynamic method hanging off of it. And this expression is going to be whatever I want to call it. I'm going to call it updated employees. And what this is going to do is call the function, a function that I've defined on my client. So let's see, what kind of things do I want to patch to this? Well, pass to this. Well, I want to pass the ID, right? But wait, I've also got to pass which property was modified and also the new value. So maybe I'm not done yet here. Let me just click that, and let me start writing the code to get the additional properties. So I want one called change property. And it turns out that the patch construct has a function for this, which is great. I'm going to make this a list. Since I'm only ever going to change one property at a time, I'm just going to cheat and take the first one. Then I'm going to define an object called change property value. And off a patch, I can do a try get property value, pass in change property, and then as an out parameter, pass in change property value. Great. So now I can go ahead and send that to SignalR. And I'm ready to go as far as server code is concerned. Now the question is wiring up the client. So that is going to require some changes to this jQuery start function here. First thing I'm going to do is create a proxy connection to my hub. Dollar connection is SignalR syntax. So this goes and gets the proxy that we've generated for the hub that I'll be showing in a minute when I go back to index.cshtml. And it initializes an object that we can use to go and talk to that, well, talk both to the server going up and also coming down. I'm also going to create a view model object that is going to instantiate my view model. Because it turns out, and this is another reason you want to write your code in an MVVM fashion, it turns out you can actually access your view model from outside of the view model, right? And so when I'm coming down from SignalR, what I want is SignalR calls into my client-side function. That client-side function accesses the view model and goes and updates the properties that I'm interested in. I'm going to throw in a helper function here just to help me get that employee. What this does is for an employee ID that you provide, it goes and looks at the employees inside of the view model. So this is the access that I'm talking about. And after you've gotten those, it iterates over them and looks for one that has an ID that matches. And so just a really quick way for me to grab that object out of my observable array collection. And now I'm going to write that function that is the client function that provides a place for the controller to call into, and I called it update employees. Actually, this should probably be update employee. Update employee equals function, and that is going to come back with an ID, a key, and a value. And then what I want to do is I want to grab that employee object based off of the key. And when I'm done with that, I actually want to go and update the employee observable to be that value. And so what's going to happen is SignalR is going to call down into your connected client. And the connected client is going to go grab the employee that was changed out of the view model and provide this property update. And then finally, I'm going to have to go and set up SignalR. So connection.hub.start. Which returns a promise, a jQuery promise, which is a fancy way of saying that I can attach a done handler to this event that will run when it's finished. And so once you've established the connection, go ahead and apply the bindings to the view model that I instantiated before. So we're looking pretty good. The next thing that we're going to have to do is go and update index.cshtml to just include the SignalR JavaScript file. And this is the jQuery client that I was mentioning earlier. And we're also going to have to reference the proxy generation for the hub so that we get access to that object. In order for this URL to work, I've got to go into my global ASAX file and call map hubs. And then I am good to go. So what's going to happen is when you send up a patch request to this employee controller, it's going to make the change, which we saw before, call into SignalR. SignalR is going to call all the connected clients here in the view model. And what it's going to do is grab that payload and apply it and update it. So this makes sense to folks? Any questions? OK, cool. Great. All right, page loaded, whoops. And now as I make the change, you'll see that indeed it gets updated on the other side as well. So now we're going to add a little bit of fit and finish. So I'm going to round out my view model for the different edit views. So you'll remember in the demo, I can click on edit, and that dynamically switches out the template to be these text boxes, and the other person gets a read view. So I'm going to go ahead and make that change right now. That's going to involve me creating a new property here called self-display-mode, which is a function that's going to take employee. And it's going to say, it's going to look for an observable object, basically, on the employee object and say, oh, sorry, an observable property. And let's see, if you're doing an edit, I want to display the edit template. And then if not, I want to display the read template. Great. And so I'm going to have to go and define this observable property. What I'm going to do is actually do this in the array map function that I had before. I'm not going to need any server changes for this since this is a client-side only switch. I'm going to set it to false because when it first comes down from the wire, there shouldn't be a need to edit it. And then I'm also going to define some functions for switching, toggling that observable back and forth. So. True, and the corresponding function here, which is called done, and sets it to false. I'm going to close files just so we're clear on what we're working with. Now I go back to my view, and what I want to do is inside of my read template, I want to create a button that's going to go call into that edit function that we just defined. And in my edit template, I want to create a button that calls into the done function. To do that, I'm going to create another column. I'm going to call that action. And then I'm going to take a table cell. I'm going to use the click binding, and that is just going to call the edit function. You'll notice that I had to do this special variable root. That gets you to the root context, and so that's the self variable that we had defined previously. And that's important because right now, if you remember, I'm actually in this data context where the edit function doesn't exist because all I'm doing is I'm looking at an employee. So context is obviously very important when you're dealing with knockout bindings. So that's why I'm needing to add that. If I do done here, I want this to call into done. And you'll notice that I have this class btn. This is another Bootstrap concept. And I'm also able to attribute this with additional classes to change the color. And so a lot of things I'm not worrying about because I get the nice advantage of having Bootstrap. Final thing I'm going to do is have this name property. Once again, I'm calling root because I'm inside of an employee. Have this map to display mode, which is what I called. Yep, that is what I called that property. So now if I refresh this page, you'll see that I get probably a JavaScript error, it looks like. So that means I made a typo. Cannot read property no type of undefined. Well, this is a case where Bootstrap doesn't necessarily give me a great error message. I'm going to guess in this particular case, because of where it is in the code, that I've done some misspelling here with my edit template or my read template. So yeah, I've never actually returned a template. So it's important that your functions return values, and that is going to fix that particular issue. So obviously, you know, not everything, as you can see, it's very easy to cut yourself if you're rushing through and you're not thinking about what you're doing. And so definitely, there's a bit of a learning curve, but it's worth it in the end because you get to write really, really clean code. So as you can see, now I've got an edit button that works and a done button that works and flips out on the client side. Unfortunately, I can actually do something like this where I don't actually get notifications on what the other person is doing. So now I want to add the concept of having a lock. And this is when things get away from just being pure client side, because if you think about it, for a lock, the server has to be authoritative. And this is when I'm going to go and update my model so that each employee actually has a locked property. So this is where we're going to take advantage of some EF code first migrations. Employee, I'm going to make this a Boolean because I'm not necessarily concerned about who has locked it, at least not at the database level. Now I'm going to go and add a migration. I'm going to call this add lock. Actually, I'm going to clear my screen so this is clear. Add migration, add locked property. That goes out, it looks at my model, and then it compares it to what's in the database, and it scaffolds out the appropriate function calls that need to happen. So in this case, I need to alter this lock column so that it gets added, and it is not a nullable. Then I just go and run update database, and that applies the changes to my database. And so now I'm going to have this lock property that I can go and access. One quick thing logistically that I'm going to do is also define a lock template. Actually, I'll copy-paste this first one. So this is a template for what I want the UI to look like when someone else has locked your entity and you're not actually able to change it. I'm going to call this lock template, predictably. And I'm going to make this top TD. Nice thing about Twitter is you can make anything a button. So I'm going to call this a button that is red. And I'm just going to say locked. And this is just going to do a straight display of whatever properties someone else is working on. OK, so now I've got to move into a couple of other things. One thing I quickly glossed over here was that because I created this edit observable, what's going to happen is because I'm looking at every single change, if you remember this helper function that we had for the keys, every time you click edit, it actually goes and makes a patch request. So that's definitely not what I want. And so in this case, I'm going to go and add a check. It says key is not equal to edit. I'm also going to add the check to say that key is not equal to locked, because I know in advance that I'm going to come down and add locked as well as an observable property. And in this case, it's going to be whatever came down over the wire. Great. So now I'm going to have to make changes on the server side. So what you would expect to happen here is when I click into the edit functionality, I go and send a message back from my client up to the server that says, I've locked this, please tell everyone else that I'm using it. And so here in this case, we don't actually have to go through web API, we're going to go directly to the hub. And that's going to give us access to the others property that says send it to everybody else, but not me, since I'm editing it. Lock is going to take an int of ID, as is unlock. I think I'll wire up the client side first. Order doesn't really matter, but it also lets me pass. So you'll notice that the view model, all it is just it's an object, it's a function. And that means I can pass in parameters to that function. And if I instantiate the view model here, I can pass in my SignalR context. Great. That means it's accessible from within my edit function and also my done function. So I'm going to say SignalR server lock employee.id and SignalR unlock employee.id. And that's going to be the client-side call into the hub that tells me what the state is of that object. So now I'm just going to write out these methods. These methods are actually going to be very similar to code that we've written in the previous controller. I'm actually going to need a database context, actually. So I'm going to go and cheat a little and copy that out of the employees controller. Obviously, there are great ways for me to refactor this code that, for the purposes of the demo, I'm not. Set the lock property to be true. Set the entity state like we did before. And then I'm going to go ahead and save changes. And here's where the interesting work happens. I say client.others call lock employee with ID. And so this is the other way down, right? And so what happens is I call up to the server, and now the server has to do the broadcast. So the other client-side code I have to write is this lock employee bit that goes and updates the view model and actually sets the locked observable property. So we're going to write that right after. I'm going to quickly copy and paste the unlocked, set this to false. As you can see, the lack of refactoring here is really starting to show as I'm copy-pasting. And then I'm going to go back to the client and write the unlock employee and the lock employee functions. And that's going to be down here. So I spelled this wrong. And I'm going to define this again. Provide a function ID here. And I'm going to do the same helper function. Find the employee. This is going to grab the observable object for the employee that is specified by the ID. And then I'm going to do employee.locked, set that to false because this is the unlock function. And then copy paste the same code and set it to true when you are in the case of locking the function. So in terms of a flow, what happens is when you click the edit button in your local instance, we call up to SignalR. SignalR goes and updates the database, so the server is authoritative, and it says, this employee is locked, no one else can edit it. And then it goes and calls back onto the clients, the other clients that did not originate the message, and tells them, okay, you need to make some UI updates. Obviously, for the purposes of this demo, this is a last write wins type of scenario, so this is not, you know, this is not really concurrency safe, but it does show the point of implementing this particular scenario and also one other scenario after it that will show. How are we doing on time? 8 minutes. Okay. I want to leave some time at the end for questions. So. Oh, actually, one piece of code we forgot to write was this display mode. This actually right now never returns the locked view that we had defined earlier. So this is pretty simple code to write. If employee.locked return lock template. Otherwise, run the logic that we had before to return either an edit or a retemplate. So you notice that also my database reseeded because I was keying off of the name and not ID. So I got another Jim Wang because it said, hey, the name in there was different. Click edit, and that did not work. So let's try to figure out what is going on here over the wire. I'm actually clicking edit, so it looks like that now we're in more of a debug type of situation. I've set edit equals to true. I should be calling up into my SignalR server. I did remember to build, I believe. I'm sorry? Yep. As a function as parameter. This one? Here? Oh, you're right. Yes, thank you. Yep, I forgot to copy paste that. Thank you. Right. Okay, thanks. Yes, so obviously if you do not pass in a variable and try to access properties on that variable, nothing is going to happen. If I make changes here, things are great. But now I guess the next question is, okay, what happened? Great, it's locked, it's last write wins, so it's prototype level code. But what happens if I disconnect? Well, it turns out I've just screwed everybody else because now the entity is locked forever. Fortunately, SignalR provides a way for you to handle these events. In the form of the onConnected and onDisconnected. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep a mapping that's going to be a concurrent dictionary. And what we're going to do is we are going to map SignalR connections to the locks, or at least the IDs of the employees that they own. So when you connect, I'm going to create a new list. Every time you lock an employee, I'm going to add to that list and say, OK, you actually own, i.e. you've locked, these particular employee entities. And from that point, I can now track when you disconnect. I can go through and look at my mapping concurrent dictionary and figure out which one of those locks I actually need to go release. So I'm going to quickly write that code up. So I'm going to try to add. We provide the connection ID hanging off of the context variable. In this case, this is going to be a new list of int. In the case of disconnection, we'll just hold off on that for now. Here, I'm going to write mapping context.connectionID. Whoops. .add employee to patch.id. Actually, I can just do ID. And here I'm going to do the same thing where I'm going to do a remove if you've done the unlock. So you've actually removed yourself from this lock, so we're good to go. And then on disconnected is where most of the work happens. So I'm going to do a for each ID in the mapping of the current connection ID. I could call unlock here, but I'm not going to want to modify the collection while I'm actually iterating over it. So I'm going to copy paste this code. Obviously, you'd refactor this. But basically, what this does is it does everything an unlock would do except for modifying the mapping. And then finally, once you're done doing all of the releasing of the locks, I'm going to remove the mapping. So try remove context.connectionID and outlist. Great. So I'm going to build this up. And I haven't fixed my database for that first entry, so that is going to be locked forever. But you know, obviously, I go and quickly fix that. If I now click Edit and disconnect my client, you'll see that all the locks are properly released, and now I don't have a bug where intermittent connections. I mean, it's not just a forcible disconnect, right? You have to understand with WebSockets, we try to keep the connection alive, but say someone connects in from a mobile device and they lose internet, you know, that's a disconnect as far as we're concerned, right? So it doesn't have to be explicit user action. So really important to guard against those types of scenarios, and SignalR does provide you with the additional overrides that you need in order to handle them appropriately. So that's all I had in terms of demo content. One thing I will add is that if we had more time, we could also go and add additional controllers to our OData additional methods to our OData controller for adding and deleting. Because we've written our app in a nice MVVM fashion, those actually aren't that hard to do, but I do want to leave some time for questions. So that there's some links in the slide deck. Slide deck will be available. And that is it. So hopefully this was helpful for folks, kind of showing how to start from the ground up, integrate Web API OData, and take SignalR and Knockout.js and build a nice, really nice demo in terms of being able to provide real-time updates for Grid for multiple users. Does anyone have any questions? I'm sorry? That is a good question. I did not think of that. OK. My GitHub is actually this right here. That did not work the way I thought it would. It's GitHub/Turnock. I can pull it up and just leave it on the screen if you guys are interested. I haven't checked it in yet to public, but I will right after this talk. And apparently I don't have internet. Here's the URL. Cool. Any other questions? Sorry, lights are a little blinding. Okay, cool. In that case, if anyone has any additional questions, please come by down to the stage at the front, or if you have any feedback for us in terms of the direction that we're going with some of these technologies. Thanks for the talk. Hopefully you guys learned something. Thanks.